From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. No more numbers. Say their names. That's the motto of a new campaign by the nonprofit Marylanders to Prevent Gun Violence. Behind the Statistics aims to build a personal connection through portraits and essays between the public and those devastated by gun violence. We speak to Jan Polyakonis, president of the coalition, and Cynthia Kiki Collins, a member of Mothers of Murdered Sons and Daughters.
I won't be able to see grandkids or see him get married or to hear his voice again, so I'm his voice. And I'm mad. Not mad in a bad way, but it's pushing me. It's giving me purpose.
Then University of Baltimore law professor Michael Meyerson describes the legal challenge facing Maryland's assault-style weapons ban. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. As investigators sort through the events of Sunday's mass shooting in Las Vegas, details of the lives of the 59 victims killed in the attack are emerging. Sandy Casey was a special education teacher from California. Charleston Hatfield was a Nevada Army National Guard Sergeant First Class. Doreen Anderson was visiting Las Vegas from Alaska with her husband and two daughters. Chris Roybal was a Navy veteran who served in Afghanistan. These men and women are more than victims. They are mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, valuable members of their communities. Here in Maryland, an art campaign by the nonprofit Marylanders to Prevent Gun Violence aims to accomplish a similar task, reveal the personal stories and real faces of people impacted by gun violence. Behind the Statistics pairs black and white portraits of victims, their families, doctors, and community leaders with essays about the impact of gun violence. I'm joined by Jan Polyakonis, president of Marylanders to Prevent Gun Violence. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
And also with us is Cynthia Kiki Collins. Welcome.
Thank you.
Jan, tell us about this campaign.
So this campaign started because I've been working in gun violence prevention for about 5 years. And I noticed that different types of gun violence and different gun deaths are treated differently. After the horrible shooting in Vegas, you know, we've seen what happens after every mass shooting. There's a national outcry. There are headlines with photographs of the victims. People say their names, just like you did just now. And that's incredibly important because if we want to make real change, we need to connect with the victims and we need to understand the scope of this issue. But in Baltimore, when people are killed every single day, and I think it's important to remember that over the last 2 months, just as many people have died from gun violence in Baltimore as were killed in the Vegas shooting earlier this week. And we don't learn their names, and we don't see their faces. In addition to that, there are gun suicides that happen every single day. And a lot of times these victims and their families aren't part of the conversation about how we move forward and we help prevent future deaths.
So you took that insight and decided to do what with it?
So I took a few photography classes after I had children. And I decided that if no one else is going to show their faces, I was going to. And so I started to reach out to victims that I've known in survivor groups that I've connected with over the last few years in Baltimore. And I decided that I was going to take their photographs and tell their stories. And folks like Kiki have been so generous in sharing their stories because it's not easy to do. You make yourself vulnerable and put yourself out there, being able to share your pain. And I wanted to be able to make sure that the rest of the public understood what that pain was like and so that they could become more engaged and part of that same dialogue about how to prevent gun violence.
I'm sure it is really hard. Kiki, you lost your son, Dante Dwayne Collins, last July. Tell us about Dante.
Dante was everything. He was just a bright young man. He was a take charge, go-getter. He just was a big motivator to others, and he just wanted to change the world. And if he could, he would have.
He was 22.
22
right?
years old. And he played basketball all through school. And he went to school for welding, took up some classes, and he actually obtained a job in D.C., Washington, D.C., as a welder. And that was a shock, but he loved it.
And that was a shock?
Yes, because we don't normally hear people wanting to be a welder, you know, in our family. And I don't think I've ever heard of any friends of mine. And he said, "Ma, I went online and I researched it, and it's good money." And I'm like, "Wow, okay." And that's the type of things that he did. He just took the initiative and did things that would better him to better our family. He always was looking to better our family, not just himself.
He had actually moved out of Baltimore, right?
Yes, he moved to Glen Burnie, Anne Arundel County area.
How did his death impact your family?
Oh, gosh. It's not the same. It's a pain that's indescribable. And it breaks the family, you know, it's a disconnect. Everybody is dealing with their own hurt. So it's hard to just, you want to put a piece back together and you can't. So it's like a link is definitely broken out of the chain and the missing puzzle piece is gone. So it's just always that something you're trying to find to go back to normal. But it's not, you can't go back to normal. This is our new normal. So it's hard. It's hard on the family dynamics. It's definitely hard.
The state's attorney's office decided not to bring charges in your son's murder. What was your reaction to that?
Anger. And I didn't feel anger throughout the whole year. But I was angry because I felt like my son deserved that. He deserved, even if a jury said not guilty, I just felt like my son deserved, he deserved a trial. He deserved it. He deserved to be represented well. I do my part on the street. I do my part any way I can to be a voice for him. But I couldn't do my part in the courtroom. And that hurt. That hurt. Because I just felt like, okay, it's okay that he was murdered. It's okay that, you know, this happened. So, you know, I've just felt angry. I felt angry that he wasn't represented. Nobody made sure he was okay, even in his death.
And why do you feel it's so important to represent him in the world, as you just described?
Because he was mine, for one, and he didn't deserve it. And he was great, and he has so much potential. I won't be able to see grandkids or see him get married or to hear his voice again. So I'm his voice, and I'm mad. Not mad in a bad way, but it's pushing me. It's giving me purpose. So He deserved his voice to be heard.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Kiki Collins, who lost her son Dante in 2016, and with Jen Polyakonis, president of Marylanders to Prevent Gun Violence. We're talking about Behind the Statistics, an art campaign that aims to put a face to stories of gun violence. Jen, where do you find these stories? How did you make contact with Kiki, for example?
So I met Kiki through an organization called Mothers of Murdered Sons and Daughters, and we work with them a lot. We organize different events to try to raise awareness about this issue and also work on legislative advocacy work to make the law stronger to prevent gun deaths in Baltimore. So I've known Kiki for about a year now. We also think that it's really important in our organization to support the victims and family members of gun violence, not just to use their voices for our purposes, but also to support the survivor groups and their own missions. So Elizabeth Bannock, my executive director, we try to attend as many of their prayer marches and memorials of their children as much as we can to make sure that we're sharing this responsibility and that we're supporting one another in all of our goals.
Tell me about some of the other people who have participated.
One woman that we just photographed the other day is actually Erica Bridgeford, who helped organize the Baltimore ceasefire weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And she took us to the location where her brother had been shot and killed about 10 years ago. Everyone has a story. We have photographed a woman named Alice Oakes, whose her two sons have both been shot and killed. We have photographed Cynthia Bruce, whose son, Marcus, was shot and killed 19 times in the middle of the day. We photographed a woman named Dorothy Paul, whose son Peter took his own life with a firearm. We photographed Greta Willis, whose son Kevin Cooper was shot and killed in his own home by a police officer. And so we try to make sure that we are talking about all different types of gun violence and hearing from all different voices, so all of their stories can be heard. And one of the reasons is because of what Kiki was just talking about, the fact that her son deserved more. Her son deserved not to be shot down on the street, and he deserved his day in court. And I think that a lot of times, to protect ourselves, the public makes excuses as though if you've been shot and killed in Baltimore, you must have been involved in crime, you must have been involved in drugs, and you make excuses to make sure that you can tell yourself it won't happen to my family. And that's not true. You know, Dante did nothing wrong, and this still happened to him. And you have mothers who try to raise their kids to protect them and keep them away from crime and from trouble and from drugs, and they're still falling into the same trap. It's everywhere. And I think making sure that the public understands that no one deserves this. No one deserves to be shot in the street. We have to make sure that we're including them and not judging victims, so we can work towards solutions together.
Kiki, tell me about Moms of Murdered Sons and Daughters. What does it do? Why did you become
goodness.
Part of it?
They are awesome. Ms. Daphne Austin, I thank her over and over again for having an organization such as Mothers of Murdered Sons and Daughters, because it gives the mothers that are able to have a voice, that are able to march, just an outlet. We gather on Tuesday evenings, and we have a support group. And to be around mothers that feel the same pain. And when we go out and march, it's so inspiring, it's so uplifting. It just gives you some type of, like, power. It makes you feel like you're really doing something to change. And it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. You're not scared when you're around the same guys that's out there on the corner selling drugs, that's out here committing some of these crimes, because you want to feel like, okay, I want to touch someone else. And it's just an awesome organization, an awesome, awesome organization.
Jen, Maryland has some of the strictest gun control laws in the country, assault weapons ban, high-capacity magazine bans, mandatory background checks, prohibitions for individuals with convictions for violent crimes or histories of mental illness. What can be done to reduce gun violence when there are already so many laws on the books?
Well, there's a few different problems. One of them is the fact that Maryland has strong gun laws compared to the majority of states that have no gun laws or very, very loose gun laws. So we look really good in comparison. But the big issue is that there's so little done on the federal level. And of course, Maryland is not an island. The majority of our guns that are used in crime come from states with looser laws. They're driven up, you know, 95 from states like Tennessee, and they're brought into our streets. We need to make sure that our congressional leaders are taking responsibility for the fact that citizens and residents of America are dying. And all of the guns that from these states with loose laws are being taken up here to Baltimore, where we do have these stronger laws, but we're not immune to gun trafficking. We need to increase the resources at the ATF to prevent gun trafficking.
The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Yes,
that's
right.
The federal agency.
The federal agency.
Right.
They have very little resources to actually deal with guns and gun trafficking. We need to increase those. And additionally, in Maryland, we need to make sure that the laws that we've passed are being implemented to the full extent and being funded to the full extent. And we need to do a really important gun trace study so that we can understand exactly where the guns are coming from and when they're being diverted to the underground market and being sent to the streets of Baltimore, so we can find policies that are actually going to prevent that from happening.
So connecting that with a point you made earlier about how the public seems to pay a different kind of attention to the aftermath of a mass shooting compared to the daily experience of homicides on the streets, do you see a way of harnessing the concern to have an impact? Do you see a way of moving forward?
I think the only silver lining after the horrors of a mass shooting is that it again increases the national conversation about this issue. Right now, I know that there was a big press conference down in Washington, D.C., where our leaders and advocates and citizens were there trying to raise up for policies that are going to prevent this from happening again. So we can fight for an assault weapons ban on the federal level. We can fight to make sure that it's included. Some of the accessories that can, you know, simulate this automatic gunfire are also banned. We can fight for stronger background check systems on the national level as well to keep other states from being able to have dangerous people who should be prohibited from getting firearms and then, you know, either doing carnage where they are or sending those to Maryland. So I think the one thing that we always see happen after mass shooting, which should never end, is the fact that a conversation has started and a dialogue has started. But I think we also need to make sure that that's translated to understand that this is happening every single day. And when we discuss policies that are going to affect real change all over the country, no matter where you live and what city you are in, that we're talking about policies that are going to affect change everywhere and for all different types of gun violence as well.
Kiki, what would you like people to remember at this time?
I just wish that we just love each other a little bit more. There's just so much hate in the world. I just pray that the kids, the young adults that's committing these crimes, just reach out to someone and that we're able to reach out to them to stop this violence.
I really do appreciate your sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
Kiki Collins lost her son Dante in 2016. She's a member of Moms of Murdered Sons and Daughters. Jen Polokonis is president of the nonprofit coalition Marylanders to Prevent Gun Violence. You can see the portraits and read stories that have been collected so far at behindthestatistics.org. Short break on the record. When we come back, a challenge to Maryland's ban on assault-style weapons is before the Supreme Court. We'll speak to a constitutional law professor about that. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Following the mass shooting of elementary school children in Newtown, Connecticut, Maryland's General Assembly in 2013 passed the Firearms Safety Act, which banned assault-style weapons as well as the magazines with a capacity greater than 10 rounds. While the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit upheld the law, overturning a ruling by a smaller panel of that court, the case made its way to the Supreme Court. The law's challengers, which include gun clubs and firearm dealers, argue that Maryland's law bans guns that are protected by the Second Amendment. In late August, 21 state attorneys general filed a friend of the court brief opposing Maryland's law. Joining us to discuss this case is University of Baltimore DLA Piper Professor of Law and Director of the Fannie Angelos Program for Academic Excellence, Michael Meyerson. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So this case involves an earlier Supreme Court ruling, D.C. versus Heller. Tell us about that case.
Okay, so in that case, the Supreme Court did something very new but very incomplete. They ruled that for the first time that the Second Amendment grants individual people the right to own firearms. And so they said, this is not, the Second Amendment has language about militias. The court said, ignore that. We have hereby ruled there is an individual right of individuals to own firearms for self-defense. That's the new part. The incomplete part is they also said, however, we're not saying there's no regulation possible. Certainly regulation is possible, and certainly not all weapons are covered. And so they said that, but then they did not clearly say either what weapons were covered or how covered weapons could be regulated.
So they raised questions as well as setting up this individual right.
That's correct. So we know that a total ban on all firearms is unconstitutional, but we really don't know much more than that. So we still, and if you want to think about it, legally, there were two distinct questions. One is what firearms are covered by the Second Amendment, and if a firearm is covered, when is the government allowed to regulate anyway?
So the Heller case back in 2008, as I recall, was around handguns.
Yes.
And now we're talking about Maryland's ban on assault-style weapons. Does that make a difference?
Well, that's the $6 million legal question, because there's a powerful debate, and even in the decision of the Fourth Circuit that struck down, that upheld Maryland's law, there were four judges who said, no, let's understand that what we mean by a weapon covered by the Second Amendment is any weapon commonly used for self-defense. And so for some judges and some justices, like Justice Thomas and Alito, if many, many law-abiding citizens are using a certain kind of weapon, including a semi-automatic rifle, for self-defense, then it is protected by the Second Amendment. Other people say, no, you look at the capacity for danger. And Las Vegas perfectly illustrated how a semi-automatic weapon can be transformed into an essentially machine gun and cause the havoc it did. So it is factually a difference, but the Supreme Court has never said whether it's a legal difference. And that is the question the Supreme Court has been invited to talk about.
I said this case is before the Supreme Court. They have agreed to hear it.
No, they have not.
Okay.
They have not yet decided whether to hear the case or not. They've been invited to, but they have avoided almost every case involving regulating rifles and semi-automatics in any meaningful way. So the Supreme Court has avoided these discussions up till now.
And obviously there were some controversial issues of all kinds that the Supreme Court was sidestepping when they didn't have a full nine justices, when there was
that is absolutely correct, and that's sort of one of the intriguing questions for court watchers. When the court was split between four general liberals and four general conservatives, they didn't want tie votes, so they put off questions, and some of those issues will be resolved, I am fairly certain, this year. This gun question is a different kind of question, though, partly because it's very hard to draw a line, and partly because some of the judges talking about this have said, if we rule incorrectly, there's going to be blood on our hands. And I think after something like Las Vegas, I think some of the justices, even those tending to be pro-gun lobby, if you will, are going to be very afraid to going all the way to saying that these rifles that can become machine guns are fully protected by our Constitution. Let the people have their way with it. So I think there's going to be incredible fear or reluctance by the court to get into the details unless they want to say this can be regulated. I think it will be very politically dangerous for the court, even though they're not a political branch. It will still be very unpopular for them to wade into this, and they don't really have to.
There's also a question, at least a question in my mind, of what kind of scrutiny would be applied to Maryland's law if the Supreme Court did look at it. Can you clarify for me if there's a particular standard of scrutiny that the court would bring to bear?
That is one of the fundamental questions dividing the judges who have talked about it so far. If you want to think about it this way, when the government regulates speech, we are so concerned with government censorship and opposing their, silencing their opponents, we say government can only regulate the content of most speech if it is necessary for a compelling interest. For example, stopping someone from giving away, you know, war secrets or something like that. Otherwise, guys, if you can't prove it's absolutely necessary to silence, let them speak. There are other times, though, where the government says, the court says, well, you don't need a compelling interest. It doesn't have to be necessary. But as long as you have a pretty good reason, let's call it a substantial interest, and it's pretty necessary, pretty useful, then we'll uphold it. That's sort of sometimes called mid-level scrutiny. So the Fourth Circuit that upheld Maryland's law said, we're not going to require the government to prove this ban is absolutely necessary. As long as they can prove that it's pretty useful for a pretty important idea, even if there are other ways of accomplishing it, we're going to uphold the law. However, many judges and the NRA want to say, no, until you can prove to us that any regulation of a gun is absolutely necessary, it will be struck down. And in the Heller case, the Supreme Court never said what standard would be used. And in reality, compelling interest test, the government usually loses. Things aren't usually necessary. In the lower level scrutiny, the government usually wins. So even though this is a very legalistic battle over standard, it ends up being, is the law more likely to be upheld or not? And the Supreme Court has given zero guidance.
I really appreciate your walking us through it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Michael Meyerson is the DLA Piper Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore and director of the Fannie Angelos Program for Academic Excellence there. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cass. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.